Hi, I'm Christina Wilfor, a host of Fat Miss Hand, a podcast with change agents across the globe working for equality. In this edition of the podcast, I'm really excited to talk about the role of media in perpetrating sexism and stereotypes and how to push back against it. We will look at Ukraine context of this issue, but I believe that it applies to a lot of different places, including the U.S., and what needs to be a more concerted effort there. There's no one better to have this conversation with than Irina Slavonska. Since she's a journalist, a feminist, and an activist, she is also one of the producers and behind Povaha. It's a platform meaning respect in Ukrainian, which we'll talk about. And it's monitoring and creating a mechanism to push back against sexism and raise issues of gender bias and equal opportunity in politics and society in Ukraine. Irina works for the public broadcasting station in the cultural section here in Ukraine, which is a really important and rich content that is coming out for Ukrainians and on a variety of topics, and important that it has this level of investment, I think. Prior, she was with a program we'll hear a bit about in radio. She writes for many publications, including Elle Ukraine, and pre-Euromaidan, she worked on a very popular TV channel, TVI, where she was the author and presenter of some shows. And together with 36 colleagues, Irina quit this channel to protest against non-transparent change in management, which was really part of the negative media environment at this time, the oligarch-controlled communication that was trying to really manipulate and drive things in a different way. So we'll hear about all of those things. Lots to talk about. Welcome, Irina. It's really nice to get to turn the tables with a journalist. Since it's usually you doing the interviewing.
Yeah, it's nice to me too, actually, to be in this different role of being the entity for this kind of talk show.
Okay, good. So how would you characterize the situation in Ukraine with everyday sexism?
I think the answer can be very large because it depends also on context we are speaking about. Speaking about daily sexism in the field of journalism, we can talk about, for example, some routine sexism in the level of vocabulary used by Ukrainian media, talking and speaking about women in politics, for example, women in the business sector, especially about women on the top management positions and so on. Also, I think we can speak about sexism in the newsrooms, about women receiving lower positions and men working on the level of top management in the media and being owners of media, especially in private sector. And also, of course, we can speak about sexist daily things we can see in the advertisement. The ads is a very important part of media. You can see it in any page of a fashion magazine, for example, and on the internet and so on.
Which I noticed a slight improvement, but it still is, I think, present. I remember when I was living here prior, it was just pervasive, you know, a naked woman for selling sushi, a pharmacy with a scantily clad nurse in a short skirt. So tires have been sold that have naked women. So I would like to hear where you see improvements and how something that is so normalized, you can raise it in a way that doesn't sound like what someone characterizes sort of hysterical feminists making a big deal out of things that are, you know, part of our style and culture.
I think the main improvement is the fact that the newsrooms are ready to talk about sexism and ready to talk about feminism. I see that even the big national important media, TV media and online media, for example, ready to invite Povaha trainers, for example, to make some small training with journalists working on the daily basis and explaining, for example, which vocabulary can be used instead of discriminational vocabulary, or which words can be used, for example. Also, I see that the issue of the Istanbul Convention was very important for the improvement of the situation because it deals with a lot of other fields, for example, criminal code and the work of the police, of the Ministry of the Internal Affairs and so on. So for some newsrooms, it was maybe the first experience of talking about gender issues via the way of talking about Istanbul Convention.
Mm-hmm. Which it wasn't ultimately ratified, unfortunately. And in fact, it was a big lobbying campaign of the Council of Churches, which is driving this, you know, sort of so-called traditional values campaign, which really just means men hold their place and women are subservient. I mean, if that's the traditional values they're talking about, I don't think
most women or men benefit from that worldview, but they were effective in some having some levers of influence. So it was interesting to see how that was debated. But I like this point. The fact that it was even part of the policy agenda meant that it had to be investigated and looked at by news media in a different way. The fact that you're a journalist has to be a key point of influence in working with media. Otherwise, if it was just civil society organizations coming into newsrooms, not understanding how news is produced and the choices that any news institution makes, I think would not be very effective. So tell me the unique role that you're able to have as a journalist talking to your peers.
I think it can be a conversation about being trusted by other media. Me, for example, as a journalist, I have the experience of working for the independent media and a media clean on the level of working with oligarchs, for example. It was independent, commercial or not media, but without any BS from some political side. I think the reputation is very important to be trusted. And also this manner of speaking about inside things, to see how the news is produced and to see what is a newsworthy thing and how can we approach gender agenda, for example, by the issue of the work of parliament, for example, like Istanbul Convention, by things dealing with criminal code, like the issue of domestic violence in Ukraine, also things about advertisements, for example, or show business or other things. That's why I think from my perspective, it is very important to talk with the newsroom about some very practical and very concrete things, like the vocabulary, for example, like some practical little things you can change in your daily work, maybe to look more for the neutral titles, to use some words without discriminational bias. So this kind of explanation does work. And I see that sometimes changes is like a virus. There is enough to have one person in the newsroom working differently. Mm-hmm. And you see there is other colleagues trying to repeat the same experience.
Mm. And do you think because they see it as a better way to do their job, a more modern way in which to be a journalist and gather news? Because what is the incentive? Or just because they're being faced with the inequity of the situation? And individuals like you and others from the network saying, here's how things could change a bit in your reporting.
I think given more female perspective can provide better reporting for a newsroom, for example. While speaking about experts in the media, I think in the USA, like in Ukraine, there is a lot of male experts speaking about some serious things like politics, economy, and so on.
Yes,
I'm joking, of course.
Yeah,
mansplaining in the broad meaning of this word, anywhere in media. In Ukraine, there is the same thing. We have some politologists, for example, five best experts on politics. They are male. Best, I mean, the more popular because they're invited anywhere, any TV show, for example. And there is a lot of work to explain to the newsroom that it is possible to invite women speaking about economy and sociology.
Wow.
Such a surprise. Yeah. And actually giving them the choice and providing some new names maybe and some good experts from the academy field, for example, from the university, being very good professionals, it can help newsrooms to provide better expertise and to make better reporting.
Which you modeled after the U.S. form of what's called SheSource, which is a database of experts for exactly this purpose. So how you can package and show that there's women expertise, well, not just women expertise, there's expertise and they happen to be women. And so talk to someone who's not just a man on this issue. How is that database going?
In the framework of the Povaha campaign, we started our database, the database called Ask a Woman. It's a funny title, I think, and it was a lot of irony inside. And we created this database with 300 female experts from different fields. And this database is functioning like user-generated content. So it was created like a Google form. Any person still can fill in and propose candidate to become expert in our database, Ask a Woman database. So then one of our team is verifying the data, the contacts, and so on. And we have 300 of experts from different fields. And to make them more visible, we are using all these instruments of social media, for example. On the Facebook of Povaha, we are publishing the profiles of our experts, especially of the experts from fields which is not considering to be a feminine fields of knowledge.
So the flip side of this is that often women are less comfortable if not given the proper training or opportunity, to put themselves forward in the media. And there's lots of programs that are helping women candidates and others to be comfortable to know how to give an interview, how to manage your message, how to pivot back to your message, all of these tools of the political consulting arena. And even friends in the U.S., for example, who would not want to do the TV show that they're asked to do because now they have to think about what they wear and how their hair looks, and not because they're incredibly vain, but because it's part of the image that they'll be judged for, versus a man who can look like he rolled out of bed and has, you know, soup on his tie and, you know, his hair is messed up and is perfectly fine. No one would take notice and they would continue to listen to him as the expert. So there's this other dimension of this problem. How do you see this from the Ukraine perspective?
An important problem, even if it looks like some small, tiny part of the work of the of experts, for example, or of a journalist, especially a female journalist or female politician, for example. We, in the framework of the Povaha campaign, we are trying to provide this kind of training to activists of feminist movement in Ukraine. We tried to make the first one this winter. We invited one of the very good communication experts, being a part of our Ask a Woman database, actually, to provide this training. It was 2 hours of very interesting conversation about interesting details of being presented in public, how to talk, how which pose you can take to feel more comfortable, and other practical advice. I think maybe we should continue this kind of training for female activists, but from the other side, it cannot change the attitude of some media presenting women from only this perspective of being beautiful or not beautiful. You can see it, for example, reading articles and news and comments about Ukrainian Minister of Health, for example, Ulana Suprun. Very often she's considered to be not enough feminine, for example, because she's wearing jeans and sneakers and she has his backpack and so on. So it's not very typical image of a Ukrainian female politician. And also there is a lot of this routine-based sexism against women in the media. For example, female MPs asked about some family recipe, how to prepare some traditional dish, for example, for Christmas and other things, but not about their laws, for example. And you cannot change it by one or two trainings.
Right. Often when we look at the media bias, you have to think about it from the perspective of media isn't necessarily telling you what to think, but what to think about. Right. So if the subject matters aren't creating the space to. So does the health minister push back on this, or anyone come to her defense to say, quit focusing on her appearance and what she's wearing? Let's talk about the agenda of what the ministry is doing.
I like very much that our health ministry is ready to talk about sexism and about being feminist. She's one of the voices of the Ukrainian feminism. And I personally appreciate it because, for example, once she was one of speakers for our round table prepared by Povaha campaign. And I think it's very important because she's not an activist, not some NGO feminist and so on. She's just the Ministry of Health, but it's interesting to see her in this role. And also, of course, there's a big conversation about the framework of the female dress code.
In the
government,
parliament?
For example. In government.
Because there's a dress code for government.
Yeah, it was created once on the time of the government of Azarov, on the time of it was the time of Yanukovych as president. And I think this conversation restarted this year, just after Katerina Levchenko being named as gender representative in the office of Vice Prime Minister Ivana Klimpuš-Cincadze. And Mrs. Levchenko was talking about finding some normal dress for this new job, because she was reading this dress code rules and worrying that she hasn't any appropriate dress, for example, for this. And it was a very funny conversation, actually, because a lot of female ministers and women working in the government was ready to speak about it and to speak out about their uncomfortable way to read this dress code rules, for example. And actually, it was cancelled. So now there is no dress code rules in the government.
Good.
Yeah.
Progress, which to even cite the minister in the way that you do, talking so openly about feminism, is just an incredible shift in a relatively short amount of time. I would say 10 years ago, the overall sentiment was that feminism was a bad word. There's not a lot of, at least on the public official level, of anyone being willing to embrace that, speak openly about it. How has that changed? Why has that changed?
I've already made this joke about virus.
Yes.
So I think
the feminism virus.
Yeah. Feminism virus. Actually, that's true, because I remember the starting point of my career in 2006 and 2007. I think it was the time where there was only two or three public feminists, and it was very scary to talk about it. And now you see that there are some public figures ready to talk about feminism, and in this context, to have Minister of Health talking about feminism is very important for maybe for the next generation also.
Mm. The outside view of Ukraine in on these issues is complex. One of the challenges I battled through, my private battle, with expat men who were coming here to find their Elena or Vitalia or whatever their Ukrainian sweetheart was, and to didn't accept that this was a form, in essence, of trafficking. The marriage business, the conditions that led to a situation where a woman from the village may want to marry a man in his 50s living outside of Ukraine for the hope that there's some kind of opportunity. If you have low economic opportunities for women, then it creates this breeding ground. And not that people haven't met Ukrainian women haven't married foreigners and have wonderful relationships, so it's not to put an overall stereotype of this, but the industry of the so-called mail order bride and the amount of these types of marriages that have partly shaped the way some think of Ukrainian women. Like, for example, I was even Googling Ukraine women for a presentation looking for something on something professional. And you can imagine in a general Google search, if you enter Ukrainian women, you know, what comes up? It's hard to say because you're in the inside. But when you see sort of these outside characterizations around some of this both real issue of trafficking, a version of this, as well as just expectations of Ukrainian women to look and act a certain way. How does this manifest itself locally? How do you fight against it and reframe and rebrand?
I think that there is a very important to have a more visible women working in this kind of serious fields, being ministers, being businesswomen, being part of the Ukrainian diplomacy and so on. I think that they are visible figures can influence a lot this image and stereotype of the Ukrainian male bride, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is a part of this job to present more women in the strong positions, more women in some top management positions, for example. And also, there is necessary to understand that this kind of mail order bride, like this enterprise and other similar initiatives, there's a kind of human trafficking, and it needs a lot of solidarity from the side of other Ukrainian and international, and also from women of international society, to see these young women as maybe a kind of victims.
Mm-hmm.
Of sexual abuse, of sexual aggression, of sexual exploitation, and not as this easy women ready to quit Ukraine and go abroad.
Mm-hmm. I do have one story that worked out in the reverse. For I was on a literal campaign every time, and I would always get sucked into it. Someone would say, oh, my friend Brad is coming from D.C. or wherever, London, and you're in Ukraine, so you might want to be helpful or reach out, or he'll reach out to you. And so then I was always thinking they were coming for business. And then I meet with, you know, Brad, and he's there on his love quest. And one, names have been changed to protect the victims, but one man who was very successful, very progressive minded in from the U.S., came and married his Ukrainian partner in this case. And I had said, you know, this is not necessarily the right way to do things, and it may not turn out the way that you expect. And lo and behold, a couple years later, they were divorced, and she benefited economically with $6 million. He was a very wealthy man. And I thought, good for her. You know? I mean, not that that would also be the stereotype of the incentives of these women. But in this case, you know, I think it was win into it, taking advantage, you know.
Maybe, but in the same time, I'm thinking if there is a good price to pay for being, for example, exploited.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And away from family. And
yeah. These are $6 million enough?
Yeah. Good point. What do you face, or maybe it was more in the earlier stages, just being a young woman in journalism? Was there, as a profession, you know, instances in which you felt there was some level of discrimination?
Actually, I think I am very lucky because I'm always was working for newsrooms without any toxic atmosphere of discrimination, for example. But of course, being a young journalist, I was suffering. Maybe there is a kind of too strong word to use, but I was remarking some kind of ageism, because you can look like a young girl starting your journalist career and so on. And I remember that the first years of my work, it was very hard to be taken seriously, actually, because she looks like a girl.
So what were your coping skills for that? How did you manage?
Maybe by being a little too much serious, maybe by asking a little bit too much serious questions and acting without any easiness, you see, without any spare smile, maybe without any easy gesture and so on.
Now, but sometimes women can't afford to, right? So this is the situation in which you have to prove
sometimes,
your credentials.
Of course, speaking about some young artists or young activists, but in this framework, we were on the same boat, being both young professionals, he or she, like young artists, for example, because I started from the field of art journalism and contemporary literature journalism, and me being, for example, young journalist. But for example, speaking with some patriarchs of Ukrainian literature and so on, it wasn't easy. But now I think this is the situation changed. There's a lot of young professionals working in the field of journalism, even on the some top management positions. And now I think there's less ageism against young female and male journalists.
And this is an area where I think it's been difficult for men to understand the experience of women. The male reaction, I think, to the Me Too movement is another example of otherwise men who just had no clue that every woman they know has a Me Too story. I mean, I literally do not know one woman in a professional and even not professional sense above age 18 who doesn't have some story of being harassed or attempted to take advantage of. So that awakening among men was, to me, in some ways more interesting to see unfold, the sort of apologizing for all men. And then how women have tried to direct some of that. Well, what it means is you can also fight for our voice and equality in the workplace and safe spaces. And so seeing how women manage it, I think, is so important for the growth that has to happen on both ends. When I was young and running my own organization in the U.S. at a pretty young age, and I had a lot of work with labor unions. So these are men in there. I mean, steel workers and nothing against the steel workers, but Teamsters and others who were funding a lot of the campaigns that I was supporting. And I would go out to dinner with them. We're at a conference or wherever we are. Could never have too much to drink, certainly. Can't joke in the same way. I have to establish that I'm smart and my credibility before I could be myself. And this wasn't soul crushing. This is just the way it was. But it's those kind of experiences that I think men are now just catching up to in what women have to manage in order to be seen in the same equal light.
Yeah, that's true. I remember my conversation with one of the board of directors of a public broadcasting Ukrainian company, and we were talking about Me Too movement and about the Ukrainian movement that appeared just a year before. Я не боюсь сказати, I'm not afraid to tell. And it was also about the experience of domestic and sexual violence talked by Ukrainian women and girls and young women and old women about their own experience. And Roman Vintonev, one of the board of directors of a public broadcasting company, told me that summer, it was the summer 2016, he was discovering that actually any woman in Ukraine had this experience. That summer he had his daughter, and he understood that the society in which this kind of experience is possible is so dangerous for this little girl, and she will grow up and maybe she will face the same experience. And personally for him, as he told me, it was very important to discover it. It was very frightening for him, but understandable as one of target to face and to work with.
Absolutely. I think men with young daughters is a huge persuasion opportunity because they also want the same rights and access and paycheck for their daughters, and who in many cases in many countries are supporting the parents. So I think it's a huge organizing moment that makes this male allies strategy effective. When you identify yourself as a feminist very publicly, you write about these issues, you work on these issues, it's seeped into your life. Do you have anyone within your family and your inner circle who doesn't get this about you or was resistant to how it's a part of your identity?
Not at all, actually.
They're out of the circle. if they are like that, they're now.
In our family, there is a huge tradition of strong women working in some interesting fields. For example, my grandmother, I appreciated her influence very much. She was very smart and she had good education and she worked very hard as a professional and she was so admired by colleagues. And I think she was an important role model for me. But speaking about some experience of reading, for example, and thinking about feminism issues. Actually, I had my diploma on French literature, and you cannot forget this first time of experience of reading Simone de Beauvoir, for example, Second Sex. And it was an important experience for me, of course, an important book for me, as for any other girl, I think.
Yeah. And for women in Ukraine who aren't given that kind of either role models or support system or access to information that gives them a different viewpoint on these issues, how do we reach them and how do we work with them and create the conditions in which they can see these issues for what they are?
I think the important method can be used. There is conversation about very practical things, about children, for example, about equal pay, about medical healthcare system and other stuff. So some important practical issues, maybe without any heavy theory inside, I think it can work. And also, I think that very important message to give is the message of sisterhood, of women supporting other women.
And do you see that kind of solidarity more in Ukraine society?
I think yes. After this movement, I'm not afraid to say, and also after another wave of this movement and hashtag MeToo, I think the conversation about the experience of being harassed and the experience of being a surviving domestic violence or sexual violence, it's something women can share with each other.
And of course, not all women are bought on to this idea and see the importance of it. In fact, the newly appointed ombudsman, I think, has some education, needs some education, she, which makes it even more challenging. So tell us a little bit about some of her comments and then how Povaha dealt with this, because you also do not want to contribute to what would be seen as an anti-woman attack or misogynist, but yet you can't let the message go unchallenged. So say a little bit more about that.
So in the Ukraine, we have a new ombudsman, and she had one of her first interviews. The first one was with me, and it was quite neutral and without any interesting, let's say that, quotations about feminism. But the second one, print for one of the internet sites and made by my colleague Irina Ramalyska, a very good, interesting and visible journalist. And Irina asked quite direct questions about the attitudes to feminism from the side of our ombudsman, Denisova. And the answer was she's not considering herself of being feminist because she loves all this attention of doors opened, high heels, shoes, and so on. All this stuff of stereotypes about real feminine.
Like male hating, bra burning, no makeup wearing women.
Yeah. And for Povaha campaign, it was very challenging to react to these thoughts. Let's say that.
Because you're being very diplomatic.
Yeah. Because, of course, there is a challenge of being a misogynist. Because Lyudmila Denisova, she's an ombudsman, she's a woman, and it was very important not to be too aggressive to her, because in any case, any people have the right being misunderstood, maybe, or being wrong. Mm-hmm. For example. So we made a cartoon about these things, about Denisova saying, I'm not considering myself to be a feminist. And our campaign was writing about our readiness to provide some training, for example, for the office of ombudsman. But we didn't receive any answer. And I think maybe we'll pay more attention to that, maybe write some official letter and so on. But it's just an idea. Maybe we'll do this.
I think building the pressure for that, but otherwise, yeah, you certainly would risk alienating or also her then looking away from certain cases that have a gender dimension as her official role as ombudsman, if not think brought to light in terms of.
In any case, even if we are speaking about it from a more absurd perspective, ombudsman as a person, as a human being, maybe have a right not to consider herself or himself as feminist, but her office should react to some gender issues. So if her office will be able to react to some things about Istanbul Convention, for example, about gender aggression, about aggression against gender activists, for example, in Ukraine, I'm okay with that.
So on a more to the issue of different gender roles within household, within society here. So you have worked to create the conditions, I'm sure, of your negotiation. And I mean, I'm married to a Turkish citizen, Kurdish man, and it took some training in the early stages around household and shared responsibility. I hope that he won't listen to this episode and know that he was the target of a campaign, an internal advocacy campaign. And we have this balance now of roles of what each does. And some of them are, they do fall into some stereotypes. You know, I don't want to kill those spiders, you know, anything, right? So these are the ridiculous things. I'm a strong, independent feminist, and I will still adhere to some major stereotypes. But how have you found in a society, in a culture where there's been a history of lack of understanding of feminism, of men playing into this system, you know, how did you find your tribe and a relationship with the options here around these topics that are clearly major values for you?
To find my tribe, I worked a lot with interest and very effective cultural managers who are women in their majority. So in the moment, you see that there are a lot of women working on the very high professional level and being so interested in their work and being so passionate by everything they are doing. You can see that all this stupid stuff about aggressive feminists and stupid girls and so on is just not working, because you see a lot of great, passionate, professional women, and they are solidarity with you, they are helping you, and together you can create some interesting projects, for example, or Povaha campaign, for example. I think there's a reality in the contemporary Ukrainian art, literature, journalism, and other field of this soft skill knowledge of women, for example, working in the PR sector, communication sector, media, and so on. So my tribe is this range of professional women. I'm working together. I have this honor to work together with them. And speaking about some more personal level, I think that there is very important to have friends and partner sharing your values. And I was lucky enough to have it.
The culture also that is in Ukraine is also very family oriented, and there's a lot of pressure, I would say, in Eastern Europe and many parts of the world for having a baby, and you're not really a real couple until you have a family. I don't have children, and I'll be 45 this year, and so I'm not having a child. And it was never a desire of mine. But I'm always having to explain this and rationalize it. And, but I like children, really I do, you know, is sort of what I feel I have to say. Or people who view you as, oh, you're a career. You emphasized your career. It's like, well, yes, I do believe in my career, but that doesn't mean that that was the reason why I don't have a child. Even the term childless, you know, has some sort of emotional kind of bent to it. How in Ukraine are women able to be married, not have children, have children? Like, what are the expectations in terms of family? Do you think that has changed and is loosening up?
It depends on family, of course. There's women who are still combining their 8-hour working day with another 8-hour working day in their houses, dealing with all these domestic things like meals or playing with children, making helping them to make some homework, for example, and so on. So I think there's something very common, not only for Ukraine, but for any other country, in families with more traditional framework of being together. But now in Ukraine, I cannot remember the right statistic, the exact statistic, but I see that the age of marriages in Ukraine increased. So there is more women creating their families after taking, for example, some important steps in their career. There are more women having their children later. For example, I have one of my colleagues working in the publishing sector who had her first child in the age of 43, I think. And I think now she can be another important role model to show that you can do both, actually. You can pay more attention to your career, and then if you are ready enough, you can have this kind of family in any age, actually.
Yeah, and the recent birth at age 50 for Senator Tammy Duckworth in the U.S. is interesting. First standing U.S. senator to give birth while being a senator is fantastic at age 50, and this is about choices, ultimately. And I think that's what we're trying to do in all of these places, is not prescribe a certain type of woman or a certain type of family or a certain type of feminism, even, but to offer the choices in which one can decide for themselves. I think that's often misunderstood.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. One of the double-edged swords in Ukraine is one around maternity leave. So you have a legacy of more generous package of maternity leave that is positive for women, I believe. And it's something in the U.S. that is one of the major gaps when you look at the have birth and get back to work 3 weeks later, and especially on different economic scales. So women of lower economic means really just don't have the options. And so this is a big problem that we have to work on. And there are efforts in which to address this, and paid family leave is passed in several states, Washington State and some others. So there's positive developments. Now, in Ukraine, you have this benefit. But then on the other hand, you have the employers who we know from research and from reports in Ukraine who are saying, well, do I really want to hire a woman? Because then I'm going to have to actually comply with this, or she's going to have her baby. How do you address this issue?
Actually, the issue which was discussed a lot in the framework of a Povaha campaign, because it deals with gender discrimination in the professional field, but also it deals with some personal experience. And I see that our readers, for example, and activists supporting Povaha campaign, very interested by personal experience. For example, one of blogs we have on our website is created by one of my colleagues, young journalist, and she's a young woman with 3 children. So she's writing about her daily experience to deal with career and 3 children in house, and how to manage this with the help of her husband, for example. And I think that this angle is very important, because the daily help from the family side is very important. And to beat these employers who are not ready to give a job to a woman because they are having this fear she will be pregnant and have a maternity leave, I think there is very important to go to court with this.
There is legislation in place that allows that for anti-discrimination?
Actually, yes. We have this law against discrimination, and the employer, for example, even didn't have a right to ask a woman about her family condition, for example. So the question about, are you married or do you have children? children out of law. So you can start your battle even on this stage of your first interview, for example.
And no photos on CVs. I found this a strange habit here. I don't know how or why, but in any other place, you're never attaching a photo on a CV because it also lends one to look at, oh, age or other dimensions of physical appearance. That's can be a way to rule certain people out in the early stages.
Yeah. I agree with you, but I think there is more something about habit. There's candidates just having this habit to add the photo to their CV.
Right, right.
But of course, I consider this habit to be completely wrong.
When you look at the digital work that you've done as in the platform of Povaha, what is the kind of content that gets most attention and reaction? Where in positive, you're not just looking for likes, you're looking for engagement. So what have you seen over this time?
So the first issue I've already mentioned, the content about some personal experience, combining career and family, personal experience of being female politics, for example, personal experience of being businesswoman, personal experience of being female IT specialist, for example, personal experience of being female activist, and any other kind of personal things. I think it's very important to publish this kind of materials because it offers the possibility to our readers to try this role model and to see themselves, for example, as another kind of activist or another kind of this super professional mom or maybe a future MP, you see, to try this role model and maybe to follow it in the future. Another important kind of content is, of course, our daily reactions to some sexist thing. For example, now we are following more daily news and reacting to some quotations, for example, by MP for some interesting stories happening in Kyiv and in the Ukrainian regions. For example, very important issue in Odessa dealing with the member of a local council. So she's a female politician on the local level, and she's dealing a lot with anti-corruption things and illegal construction things. And the issue was about posted in her quarter. On this poster, you can see some naked female figure and also some bottles presenting this woman as being drunk. And this poster was pretending that this image is the real face of this local politic. I think our reaction was very important for her protection because I think maybe it was considered as some national support because Povaha is a national site dealing with national issues.
And having also political leadership that feels accountable to the way that women are talked about or rights they're given and careful. I remember in the Yanukovych days before the World Cup or European, I think it was in 2000, must have been 2012. And the advertisement when he was actually an economic forum making a plug saying, come to Ukraine where women take their clothes off in the spring. Right. So that was the, I mean, one of many things and some more bigger, serious things that were wrong in that approach. But I think about that in the context of how this move toward a more fair and equal society in the struggle and victories for Ukraine to get there influences these dimensions.
Yeah, if Povaha existed at this moment of Yanukovych quotation about women their clothes off, I think we would react with some cartoon because we use a lot of visual content. I see that our readers and activists supporting Povaha campaign very open to react to this kind of visual joking content, actually. There's a lot of serious things all around, and I think Povaha can also be useful as a kind of media and as a kind of campaign using not too much serious content.
Yes, I think the first stage of Povaha was very a lot of long form content.
Yeah.
So I know you've moved it away to make it more shareable and to spur that conversation. Are there other countries that you think this kind of platform works in? What are the conditions in which pushback on sexism can be either needed or find success?
I remember one of my French colleagues was talking to me about the similar platform of a self-organization of French journalists dealing with daily sexism in their careers. And I think that it's great to see our colleagues in France trying to make this kind of self-organization. They are speaking about their experience. They are sharing names of more or less dangerous male politicians, for example, suspected or accused of being aggressors against for example, female journalists. And also there's a very interesting site called Balance Ton Port. Now I'm thinking how to translate it into English. It's something like Stop Your Pig. In France, in French language, pig, it means some aggressive sexual attitude. Mm-hmm. So it's about...
Yeah, we say chauvinist pig also.
And this site is full of user-generated content with some quotations of male politicians, mm-hmm. MPs and so on, speaking some stupid things about women, sexual or domestic violence and so on. I think it's great because it's funny.
Yeah.
I laugh a lot reading this site. I think humor and laugh are very important instruments to battle with sexism.
Mm-hmm. Because it can otherwise be threatening is the result. And I think it's not just some happy, you know, go-lucky future that guarantees power for everyone.
Yeah.
Right? So we're talking about leveling the playing field, and that means some people don't benefit from the current situation of privilege. And so that is a threat to some, but we have to make it less threatening and show the benefits of this kind of equality.
Yeah, that's why there is very important to address also male activists and to help them to unite with a feminist movement, for example.
And are they really out there, though? I mean, we talk a lot about this and for She campaign, UN organized, and I love the concept. And I think we have to figure out, is it, how do we find those men and activate them? In Turkey, a number of years ago, there was a high profile murder of young university woman. And it sparked the larger conversation of linking this type of violence to the subtle forms of violence in sexism and harassment and sexual harassment. It was a really interesting opening of this dialogue. And you had men protesting in miniskirts in Taksim and down Istiklal to make the point that it shouldn't matter what a woman wears and everyone deserves to be protected and safe. So, and that came up fairly organically. There was a bit of organization behind it. But what do you think can be built on here in Ukraine when it comes to the male allies and how to organize in a more strategic way with that potential?
Their potential, for example, is to vote differently. Now in the Ukrainian parliament, there is 88% of male MPs. Mm-hmm. And we see that they are not voting for the Istanbul Convention, for the ratification of Istanbul Convention in Ukraine. I hope that maybe more solidar and more pro-feminist electors, for example, could vote for women from any kind of political parties. I don't care about political orientation or ideology. But I think it's very important to have more women in parliament and to have more women in government. That's why Here for She movement, me too, I appreciate the concept very much, but sometimes I'm quite skeptical about it. But in any case, we need to have more solidar electors, to have more pro-feminist MPs, more pro-feminist ministers, and more female ministers, MPs, and other kind of country leaders.
Mm-hmm. And ministers who have authority over resources and decisions that are important. When you look at the cabinet of Macron, for example, that was one of the considerations. So it's not just having the numbers of women, it's also where, same with Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada. So it's the next sort of stage. I have one suggestion. I've always been trying to find a country that would take me up on this idea for the fight around quotas, which is at least the conversation in Ukraine has changed when you couldn't even say it without people viewing it as reverse discrimination and and all of this nonsense. And it's, or they would take the position of, well, they don't work. Right? So there's no one strategy that works to increase women's political participation. It's all of these things. And especially what you're doing is totally unique in many contexts to have a communication and demand structure for change. We put too much emphasis just on the laws that change and improving the international metrics and how a country measures up, and not enough on creating the homegrown support and demand. So I strongly believe in that. But I would love to see someone do an ironic protest during a quotas debate that demanding more men in parliament.
It would be funny.
Right? I mean, with 88% men. So maybe I can look to Ukraine. I will help organize.
Even more, 100% of men in parliament. It would be great.
Imagine how wonderful Ukraine could be. So I think, yeah, creative ways to try to raise these issues. I want to end with a question that I'm asking everyone, which is simply, what do you think will be the change for women 20 years from now?
The ratification of the Istanbul Convention in Ukraine. I think there's...
You're on message.
I think it's very important because a lot of women are dying every year because of domestic violence, and the police didn't have enough framework to react correctly. Mm-hmm. Ukrainian courts are not ready to pay enough attention to this kind of aggression. And I think there is the worst thing about it. Victims are not ready to court a suit against the aggressors. There is one thing. Another thing, of course, there is more women in the Ukrainian parliament and government. I'd like to see more than 3 female ministers in government. Maybe it would be great. Half female government? Why not? And also, I'm dreaming about having more women in the top management of Ukrainian media. Mm-hmm. Maybe powerful and professional media owners, female media owners, more women on the positions of editors-in-chief, more female top-level producers, and even one, or even better, 2 or 3 female hosts of some influential political talk show. Mm-hmm. Because now there is not.
Really?
Yeah.
So you mentioned this earlier, but just to say a little bit more about, is your philosophy that it is a ratio in the initial stage, having the numbers and having the balance is important. How do you ensure that it's also the feminist-oriented pro-women? If it's more of no offense against the ombudsman, I think she will have lots of positive work
here.
Let's hold her up to that standard. And I would look at it the same way in the U.S. If there was, you know, more Sarah Palins out in politics or Michelle Bachmann's, this very conservative woman, they're terrifying to me and I don't share the same values with them. So say just a little bit more on how you think you get the right women there who are going to support the agenda that helps everyone.
In this ideal dream about a better world, more women on the powerful position, I think that these women enough education and maybe enough training and maybe enough reflection to think more about what does it mean to be a woman in Ukraine, about all these fears and all these challenges and all this other issue we've already discussed. Maybe these women should consider what does glass ceiling is, how does discrimination function in the Ukrainian context and so on. So I think it is very important to have more women, but with strong gender-sensible positions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have great expectations for Ukraine. I've seen the change possible in this relatively short amount of time. So I think more change is on the way, and it's partly because of people like you and the organizations and platforms and creative activism that exists to continue pressing this forward. So congratulations for being a part of the change that you believe in and the new Ukraine that is happening.
Thank you so much.